Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to the Motorsport Magazine podcast. I'm Jack Phillips, digital editor of Motorsport, and I'm joined today by Simon Aaron, features editor.
Good morning.
And joining us today is a man who has played a part in some of motor racing's biggest rivalries. Porsche, McLaren, Senna, Prost, yet never made an enemy, which is quite remarkable.
Oh, thank you very much. It's not easy, but I mean, in my job at McLaren, for example, I used to look after the drivers and the team and so on. So I wasn't involved in the contracts and on the big things. Ron did all that, so it's okay. I was friend with them rather than they. It was a fantastic couple of years, especially the first one. I think it was superb. But then inevitably, you have been dealing with the best two biggest stars that we ever had in the sport, so we know it wasn't going to last too long, but when it lasted, we thoroughly enjoyed.
So that is the voice of Joe Ramirez, who delighted you can join us today.
And Thank you.
You've been over the last week or so. You've been to the Goodwood Revival, I believe.
I've been to the Goodwood Revival. It's an event that I like not to miss it, and I think this is 20 year, and I have done at least 15 of them. So it's a lovely, lovely event. I think people like myself that have been in the sport for so long have a lot to thank Lord Marchwell, Duke of Richmond now, for what he's done there, because it's really superb. It's really like a time machine, and you go back and the cars there and the people, and you know, in 3 days you meet half of your friends that you had there work and most of your life. So it's a great event.
A lot of people who spend many, many years working in Formula One tend to become slightly isolated from the rest of the sport, but it's clear, you know, your passion is clearly absolutely intact. You are a proper enthusiast who absolutely loves the whole industry, aren't you?
Yes, I guess it's true. Ron Dennis used to always criticized me, saying I was a puritan of the sport. I didn't really, and said the sport is not so puritan. You must do little things that they maybe don't confront us. But I didn't. If I was going to lose, I sort of preferred to lose at the track because we're not good enough, than rather making a little thing that it wasn't quite allowed, if you know what I mean. And a lot of the Formula One teams, they always play to the very, very line, you know, and some overtaking that line. I have to say, McLaren, we never did overtake that line, but we were always up to there. I mean, that was the good designers, that's what they do.
The McLaren drivers, you could say, sometimes went over the line a little bit.
Yes, indeed, but like I said before, it was good to work with the best two in the world, and it was hard to deal with them, but there was two guys that they were the best. You know, it's better than having two guys that you can't, they don't go, you know. So obviously, he have his ups and downs of the sport.
I mean, there are many, many things we'd like to talk to you about. McLaren, Tyrrell, Eagle, Ford GT40, so much stuff, but it's appropriate today, I think, if you don't mind, Jack, if we go back to the early part of your Formula One career, 2 hours before you joined us this morning, Ferrari announced that Charles Leclerc was going to be driving for them in 2019. And I think Charles is the youngest driver to sign for Ferrari since your good friend Ricardo Rodriguez back in the early 62.
You were right, 61.
And what can you tell us about those very early, I mean, I don't know how much English you spoke when you came over to Europe, or whether you, I presume you spoke some Italian, but what was it like in those early days? You know, there was no internet, plane travel took forever. I mean, what sort of a sense of adventure was it when the two of you came over?
Well, I think he was more fascinated the fact that you didn't have all those tools that we thoroughly enjoy these days, but he was always... it was so difficult life. Nobody did it difficult, but different than what it is now, with all these other tools. But I think the sport, I hate to say it, but it was better. I think it was more enjoyable. They have taken all the romanticism of the sport that we used to have. And as far as Ferrari signing Leclerc, I mean, it just showed that the management is changing very much. I think if Sergio Marchionne was still here, he would, and it's probably because he would like to have Leclerc, and maybe they are respecting
his wishes,
the decision that he was. But to be honest, I just learned it. I know that Lapo Ehrman has put something in the internet before, and then they have to take it off very quick. But yes, I think it was a little bit on the cards, and it does surprise me, because, and I feel sad for Kimi, because he's really doing a superb job now, which I'm sure Charles is going to be difficulty to put up with it next year. And I think it probably is going to destabilize a little bit his relation with Sebastian. And Sebastian, brilliant as it is, he kind of make almost a mistake at every race. And whether if Charles is going to make that even worse, if he's going to push him more than Kimi did, I'm not sure. Which I don't think he will next year, but after a few races next year, he's probably start pushing him hard. So we will have to see. But in a way, it's nice to see young people. And I like Charles very much. And he's not just as a driver. He's really a nice person as well. And we do need new blood in the sport.
How was Ricardo in 1961? How was he received by sort of Ferrari and Enzo? And
yeah, Ricardo was very easy to work with, to deal with him. He was a full of fun guy all the time, and for him he couldn't believe when he had the call. And when he did Monza the first year, and he was only a fraction of a second in second place on the front row beside Von Trips. And the other driver used to come and ask him, what gear are you taking in the parabolic? And why did they ask me? See, I've never done this before. But he was one of those guys that he had a talent, he born with it. It was very easy for him to go fast on the racing cars. He didn't have to work at it. He just come natural. And, you know, those kind of drivers, we see them every 10 years, you know, the pros, Senna, Schumachers, Alonso. So to be there at that epoch when he was so young, and he was kind of from Mexico, to me, it was fantastic. So sad that he lasted very little. No? So,
what was as you were working for Ferrari as an apprentice mechanic at the time? Were you traveling to the races?
Yes, I was. Well, the deal is that when I got there, I was lucky. I got there when Ricardo was driving the first race for them in the Targa Florio, not in Formula One, but in the Targa Florio. And I just said, well, look, I meet you there. I do my way, however I can, and I meet you there, and you introduce me with the people, and then, you know, it's up to me if I get something or not. And fortunately for me, Mauro Forghieri, which was his first year at Ferrari, and Eugenio Dragoni, which was the director, also was his first year. They liked my enthusiasm, you know, but they said, look, we cannot employ you. You're not Italian. You don't speak Italian yet, and you have no knowledge of the sport, although you have a lot of passion. So if you come to the races, you do your own way. At the races, we pay your hotel, we pay you your food, and we start like that. So, and this is how I did the first year, but I loved it, because I used to travel to the races with Giancarlo Baghetti, sometimes with Ricardo, sometimes with Lorenzo, but mainly with Giancarlo, because in those days they used to drive to all the races. You know, he had a Ferrari, and we used to drive to all the races. And I got there, and I, you know, the boys, the mechanics, they gave me all the shitty jobs. Nobody wanted to do it, but you know, I was enjoyed. I was doing what I liked, what I always wanted to do, learning the language, learning the mestier, the official, the work. And little by little, the mechanics used to trust me more, and they gave me more important jobs. So it was a great time. Unfortunately, that was 1962, where there was a lot of problems, industrial problems in Italy, and there was a lot of strikes, and we missed races. And yeah, however, you know, you can't have it all. It was brilliant introduction to the sport. I got a tremendous relation with Mauro Foglieri, which up to these days, and weekends I used to go to his house, and he was a workaholic. He worked all the time, but he showed me how he did things and why he did them. It was brilliant.
But your first paid job was that with Fangio. Got your first job at Maserati, is that correct?
With Fangio, he introduced me to engineer Alfieri at Maserati, and kind of the same thing. He said, look, we give you a job, we give you a car, that a letter that you have a job with us, but you got to go with that letter to the home office in Rome and, you know, find your working permit. And you, so I went up to Rome. I can't remember how many weeks I spent there, got the permit, and came back, and I had my first paid job at Maserati. Also was brilliant, because my immediate boss was Gianpaolo Dallara, and I also had a very good relation with him. And so I was a couple of months in the engine department, a couple of months in the gearbox, in the chassis department. So I learned a lot, and then engineer Dallara got the call from Ferruccio Lamborghini to do the first Lamborghini, and he said, "Joe, you have to come with us." Maserati didn't race in Formula One, but he was racing in, but not anymore in Formula One. Things stopped in 57, 58, so we were talking about 62. However, there is still racing prototypes, Le Mans, Sebring, that type of races, and when Dallara got the call, he said, "George, you're going to come with us." I said, "No, but I like racing. I like to go racing." "Oh, but we're going to go racing. Give us a year to do the first prototype, and we will do in races." Anyway, convinced me, and I thought, well, it'll be a good opportunity to make the first car from day one, and, you know, and Gianpaolo as well was a great guy, and I was lucky. I learned about so much, and then I even have the opportunity together with Bob Wallace. We used to do a lot of mileage when the car was finished to find out everything that was going to broken, and so it was tremendous. But after a year, I decided that I really wanted to go racing, and I came to England then.
On that point, I've had quite a few questions before we go back to Ricardo Rodriguez. One from Juan Carlos, who asked, as a Mexican, what was your biggest challenge trying to adapt to the motorsport industry? And then Howard B asked also, when you arrived in the UK, how did you cope with the language and the accents, the food and the winter testing at Snetterton?
I used to, when I first came, you know, the Spanish and the Italian is not that much different. It is a lot of difference, but probably if you're talking slowly, you can. And I thought I would pick it up very quickly, and I find out it was not easy. I bought myself a little transistor radio, and I had a little thing, and I stick it in my thing, and I was always hearing the news, the comedies, no music, but just to learn, and that was a great help. And the same thing when I came to England, that was even worse, because the English, yes, you learn is the basic language. Every country, your second language is English. So I did kind of got myself by to order a meal, to get a room in a hotel. But when you had to work, it's so difficult. I remember to a telephone. If I had a meeting somebody, I'd have to get the address in the telephone. I said, please, please, slowly, slowly, deletrate. Can, you know, go letter by letter, because it was hard. But when you have to do it, you do it very quick. As well as that age, it was much more easy to learn language. Yes, it's been another thing, that another, what do you call it, hurdle that you have to cross. But
what had you been doing in Mexico City immediately before you came over to?
Well, I was studying for a mechanical engineer, but that was the only kind of how could I say it, career that you can see a little bit of cars, you know. But I didn't see any cars really. It was all mechanical things, and I said, no, this is not for me. I got to go. So I only did 2-3 years of the. I was still missing 3 years to finish the career. And I remember my father was very upset because I left. He always said, "Oh, finish the career." And you know, but this is 3 years, and you know, I can learn what I want to do in Europe on 3 years. And I decided that I had to go. I used to do all kind of work to learn to earn a little bit of money, and I managed to get a free ticket to New York. I had $500. I had a ticket to New York by plane with the father of a friend of mine that was in the government. He got me that ticket to get there. And then I bought a ticket on the Queen Elizabeth, the original Queen Elizabeth, to come to England. That was €200. And that was one of the best weeks of my life. It was so fun. It was just like the Titanic film. It was brilliant. I was sharing a room with an Australian young guy that I never met him, but we really got on really well, and we had so much fun. It was a fantastic experience. And then I had $300 left, and with that I went from Southampton to the Targa Florio in Sicily in riding. It took me about a week, but I got there. And that's where I met Rodriguez and Dragoni and Forghieri.
Having given up your studies in Mexico City, I think the fact that you then had an education from Mauro Forghieri and Gianpaolo Dallara was definitely the way to, was the right way to go, wasn't it?
For me, incredible. It's really good. But as I always say, that was lucky at that time. The passion opened the doors. Today, no way. Mm.
So when you arrived at the Targa Florio, was that when you had the lap with Ricardo?
I had a lap with Ricardo. There was they used to bring there a few Ferraris GTO for the drivers to learn the circuit, and it was great. I did 3 laps with Ricardo, 2 or 3 laps, I can't remember, and then in the last laps he went by the. There were no timing laps. There were just the drivers to get in. We were timing it, but not. There wasn't like the Ferrari wouldn't know. So we passed the start and finish line. He stopped. He let me drive 1 lap. I came back and then stopped before, and he took over again. And that was brilliant, brilliant experience.
And then was it 10 years later you had a similar experience
with Pedro? Yeah, this time I didn't drive, but Pedro drove me around, and he then asked me, so how did I do in compared to how many with Ricardo? Oh, I said, well, I'll give you a 6. And he said, oh, well, good, I have a scope to improve.
That Jamie Smith, actually, one of our readers, has asked, how did Ricardo compare to Pedro? You must get that all the time.
Well, at the time, Ricardo was always quicker, and Pedro, it was always a second between them, and second, Pedro used to try so hard to get to the time of Ricardo. For Ricardo, it was easy, and often had a little chance to go off the road or whatever. It's amazing, but even in the rain, and El Comendador, Enzo always used to say, well, if it's raining, he liked Ricardo to start. Pedro or Ricardo, he said, I leave it up to you who finished. But if it's raining, he liked Ricardo to drive, you know. So, And then when Ricardo died and Pedro, without the shadow of his younger brother beating him always, he's starting to get better and better and came up to be the best, one of the best wet drivers that we ever seen. It was brilliant. Remember that race in Brands Hatch with the
917.
I remember the John Ward saying, "Has anybody told Pedro that it's raining?"
I think I read somewhere that you thought Ricardo was more natural.
Oh, completely, yes. It's like I was saying before, it was just one of those talents that they didn't need to work hard to go quick. It just came natural, like Senna, like Prost, like Schumacher. It's such a shame that he lived so short. Also because he was so much nicer person than Pedro. He was much more open. He was really, everybody was his friend. He did a lot of friends within the racing drivers. Pedro never did any friendship with another driver. He always said, "Is if you know a driver well enough that he's your friend, if you are dicing with him wheel to wheel, he will know more or less how I will react, and I will know more or less how I will react, and it's better not knowing that." I think that was his theory, and maybe it did work for him. But Ricardo was a much, he was a really character. I think he would have been good for the sport. Having said that, on those days, I think everybody were characters. There was better people than we had now.
So between, obviously, the 60s and you then, late 60s, you joined John Wire. Had you kept in touch with Pedro between times or not?
Yes, because Pedro, we're still working together, because Pedro was driving the BRM in Formula 1 and driving the GT40 or the 917. Yeah. Later with John Ward, and I was working with John Ward, but John Ward said one Mexican per car is enough, so we were not together. I was working with Derek Bell and Seifer and Joe Seifert, and other mechanics were working with Pedro and Jackie. So yes, we keep, funnily enough, when he actually died, he just moved into a house in Bray, and I was living in Maidenhead. And I said to Pedro and Glenda, his girlfriend, "Oh, you must come to dinner." He said, "Yeah." And he was coming to dinner that weekend. And then he called me and said, "Sorry, Herbert Muller have offered his Ferrari for me to drive in Norwich. And, don't worry, there'll be another weekend, you know." And then we have no news, so I didn't see any news. I come to work on Monday morning, and David York said, "Oh, what a shame about Pedro." "What do you mean, Pedro? What happened?" "Didn't you hear? No, got killed yesterday." Wow. it was awful.
I read also, between John Wire and your two stints at John Wire, you went to Eagle, and so you were living in Rye, but before that you met Dan Gurney once at the Nürburgring, and he took you round. So you do you remember much about that, the lap of the Nürburgring in Dan Gurney's Porsche?
Yes, but I also did a lap with Giancarlo Baghetti when we got there, and it was raining when we got there because I was traveling to him to the races, and when we got there he said, "Oh, let's do a lap," and so we did a lap, and you know, I was scared. And not because he was going to quit. I just didn't feel. I was thinking to myself, "My God, this is a Formula One driver." I wasn't all that. And then I did a lap with Dan Gurney. It was like night and day different. It was. I was really amazed. Always. I don't know which trip, but in one of the races, we had a crash with the Ferrari. We were overtaking a track, and the track in front that we were overtaking decided to go around another slow car in front, and he didn't see us or whatever, so he moved over and Giancarlo hit it. And I thought, I didn't see him in changing lap or, gear, or it was a little bit more space on the where he could make an avoiding action. He didn't. were just so surprised, and so we damaged the car. It never impressed me, Giancarlo Baghetti as a driver, like he did Rodriguez or Gurney or anybody else. But he won his first race, you know.
Yeah.
What was it? I mean, I had the privilege of interviewing Dan Gurney 2 or 3 times, and I just found him the most charming, eloquent, interesting man. He was superb to talk to. He treated you like a best friend, even though I'd never met him previously. I mean, what was it? His reputation in the 60s was genius driver, but quite taciturn, quite quiet, quite studious. What were your impressions working with him?
Oh, he's always been one of the best drivers at work, best friends, best bosses. It was great. He did fancy himself a bit of an engineer as well, and he was always tinkling with the car. He always, I remember in Spa, you know, we didn't have the facilities we have now. It was the track park on the road, on the dirt, the road full of stones. The car was like not straight, and he was standing on the top of the stairs to enter the transport, and he looked at the car and said, "Joe, I think we ought to put more toe in on the left front." And, you know, yeah, give it 2 turns. So of course you had to do it, and you know, then he did a lap, and he was such a good driver that he tried harder to make it, the change better. And then after, perhaps he said, "No, it was okay, but maybe better put it back how it was." So. But then what is good about it, and I love that, you know, people are still using the Gurney flap. Yes. He was the guy that invented, and he still got his name, and people still use it. And that's super that he left something that would last forever. And also, he was the guy that started spraying the champagne.
Yes,
after the race, yeah. At Le Mans. So he had a bottle and, you know, all the high rack of Porsche. Ford was there, and he thought it was a good idea to, and he was. And since then he took the bottle, he gave it to a very close friend of him that he was a journalist, and he was then got ill, and he sent it back, said, "Dan, I'm probably going to go soon. I think you better keep the bottle back." So Dan kept it for a while, and I think now he's in the Ford Museum in and that was a fantastic week for Dan, because he won the Le Mans, and the week later he won
Grand Prix.
Belgium.
Yeah.
So was that similar to when you worked with Emerson Fittipaldi? That he had a similar kind of mentality to Gurney, and a little bit too hands-on?
Similar in many ways. Also very good driver, also tingled with the car all the time. He... I hate to say that Dan Gurney ideas were probably a little better than Emerson. And with Emerson, we had so much trouble with his engineering skills. But then he was a good driver. And unfortunately, when I got to Emerson, he was already been twice world champion. He was not the same person as a driver. I think he was just missing a little bit. So many ways I could tell you his story. So the things that we have with him, maybe we don't have the time now. But like in the Monaco Grand Prix, we didn't qualify in Belgium. Then we went to Paul Ricard, and we spent 3 days testing all so many different things. Richard de Villa made a new suspension. We tried so many things. We thought we improved the car. We got to Monaco, and with Monaco we were qualifying, but just to the very end, on 20 position or a little bit less. And we were running at the end of qualified. You know how we do it. Everybody do it the same. And the last, just little fuel, just enough to do the last few laps, but I miscalculated and we didn't do the. And he came in the pit furious. He put his visor up and he said, "You better me a good lap." sorry, that's the way it goes. Don't even switch the engine off. We just put a couple of gallons or whatever in the car, put things, and he went off the pit lane. And remember how you go out in Monaco? They went sideways one way, sideways the other way. And Wilson all worried. Oh, he says he's going to kill himself. No way. He says he's probably doing a good lap now. You know, and he went that 1 second quicker than he ever did before during the whole weekend. And he put the car from 20 in seventh place. And big smile, and he said, and I was so upset, you know, and all the team was upset. He said, look, Emerson, this is what you're going to do. So all we need to do is to make you hungry. You know, the next time I make love with Ellen, I mean, in front of you. Oh, no. Yes, like I said, I think he just passed his good years. But that's a very interesting 5 years of my life where I lost all my hair.
Well, with the Fittipaldis.
It was not easy working with the Fittipaldis, but it's good. It was, they gave me my the first opportunity that I came up from a mechanic, chief mechanic, to a team manager. So I was grateful for that, and I learned a hell of a lot as well by doing a car in Brazil, and it was interesting times.
And despite what you say that in Formula One terms, he seemed to have lost perhaps a little of his motivation unless you made him angry. I mean, subsequently, when he went to America, he got it back again, didn't he?
Yes. Yes, it was a different type of racing. It was just you were not racing with the same people. The machinery, the tracks were all different. And I think, yes, he felt really well there, and he was earning good money. And so, yes, there was another... Once we were running in the British Grand Prix, and I think Hunt and somebody else lapped him in the Copper Suka, and when they lapped him, boom, he's stuck behind them doing the same lap times. And I said, but what happened, you know? where did this extra seconds came from? Oh, yeah, but I was driving like this, you know, and Brazilian expressions. I was in the limit. And what do you think the other guys were on a Sunday drive or what? Yes, it was a shame, but anyway.
That must have been basically the opposite of what it was like when you were working with Ken Tyrrell, who was the happiest.
That was really one of the best stages of my life. I mean, working for Ken, it was just like really a family business, a family affair. And Ken was the father figure, and it was so enjoyable to go to dinner with Ken and Nora and Jackie. We talk about cars, we talk about life, we talk about everything. It was just such a fantastic relation, and especially the relation that Jackie and Francois had. Oh, everything was just superb, and the team was so small. I mean, the smallest team I ever worked was, of course, Dan Gurney before, but that was a few years later. The team were getting bigger, but still, we had a picture. It's a picture in my book. I love that picture. It was 25 people, and that was everybody. The people at the factory, the people that travel, everyone. Of course, you know, we buy the engine, we buy the gearbox, we buy the brakes, we did the chassis, the suspension, the bodywork, we did all that, of course, and buy the components. But when you have such a small group of people, there are no politics in the sport, in the team. Everybody pull the same way. It's only one rope. It's just brilliant.
We've had a couple of questions actually about Sever. Stephen Gate asked, how did he stack up against the other greats you worked with? And Steve Slasky just asked for some thoughts on Francois Sever. So your opinions and memories of Francois.
Oh, he was another one. I see a lot of similarity to Ricardo Rodriguez, you know, young, good looking, loved the sport 100%. I mean, he could have been a film star, but he was, despite that, he was a very good driver. And of course, comparing to all of the, at that time, I mean, it was Reutemann, it was Peterson, Of course, Stewart. Stewart was a little bit above them for sure, but I think Francois measured really well with the other ones, and he was learning so much of Jackie, and he used to love it. He used never. I don't know. It's you seem you read my book, but I put an example of how good they got on. In the Dutch Grand Prix, they were first and second, but there was like a train all the race. And at one time, Jackie got into Tarzan corner and missed the gear. And so Francois kind of opening, and they were side by side, and then Francois put himself back behind. And when they get, at the end of the race, Jackie was first, Francois was second, and I was getting the belts out of Francois, and Jackie, he was out of the car and came in and said, "Francois, you're an idiot. It was your race. Why didn't you pass me?" And Francois said, no, I want to pass you, not when you make a mistake, but when I'm better than you." and we both said, "Bloody hell." That was Francois. It was really the relation that had. It was brilliant. And one thing that Ken was very sorry about it is that he never told Francois that Jackie was retiring. Francois saw the next year it was going to be the same. The only one that knew was Jody Scheckter, and of course Ken. We didn't. And I remember I was doing his belts of Jackie in that race, and he said, because I have a collection of steering wheels, which I'm very proud of it. I have probably the best collection of steering wheels. I'm always getting the wheels from other teams. You couldn't do it these days. But and Jackie knew that I have the collection of wheels, that I collected wheels. And he said to me, "Is this the steering wheel I've been using all the year?" And I say, "Yes, it is." He said, "If you don't mind, you think I could have it after the race?" "Oh, we can arrange that." So that was the first indication. And I thought, well, I wonder why he wants his wheel. But maybe. Yeah, that was a very sad weekend when Francois. And he was really fighting. He wasn't qualified, but this is how things were going to develop on the Saturday, I guess. And he was exchanging lap times with Reutemann and Peterson, and unfortunately he didn't come back one.
Did that weekend make you question your involvement in motorsport? Having lost Ricardo and a lot of your friends, and then did you ever question it?
It's amazing. One person that read my book, he said to me, "Gosh, I couldn't believe how many people got killed." Funny you should say that. I never really thought about it, because you're writing a book and this is why it happened. But I lost so many friends. And of course, the harder thing is when you lose a friend that he was actually driving your car. I mean, I lost Robert McLean, a Canadian driver, driving the GT40s in Sebring. And he came into the pit. We just refueled the car and put new pads and so on. It took off. 2 laps later, crash. The car was full of fuel, got fire. And when we collected, there was only his burned shoes left from. It was awful. That is probably the worst thing. You know, there was Lucky Kastner, that he was a good friend. He died in Le Mans. Other, so many other people. I mean, well, Pedro Rodriguez and Elio De Angelis later on and so on. But it really affects you when he was driving your own car, and Francois was driving my car that I worked. Because, of course, he said, "God, did I do this wrong? Was the car all right?" I remember at the time it was, you probably remember Peter Lyons.
Very good writer.
One of the guys, the good guys that come to race, that write about it, and they know what they're talking about. And he came to us after the accident. If that helped you to put your mind at rest, nothing broke in the car. He just was too quick. He lost it in the entrance. He hit the guardrail on one side, and then he went across and he hit the other. And nothing broke. I can 100%. Because Ken said to us, they took the car to a garage in Watkins Glen after the race, and he sent us Roger Hill and Roy and myself to go and see if we find anything. That the car was a mess, and it was actually bits of him there, and I remember got ill. So it was good of Peter Lyons to come and tell us that. But nevertheless, it's your car, and you feel a little bit, oh my God, what am I doing this? Is it worth doing it? Is it? But I guess the love for the sport is greater, and you overtake those situations, you know.
Before we move on to McLaren, which I think half an hour should give us enough time to cover off your time at McLaren. One question from Ricardo Tocato. Just wants a memory about Depailler. So just a memory of Depailler. He was his favourite driver, apparently.
Yeah, that's another guy. Depailler was a guy that absolutely, I never met anybody so fearless. Absolutely had no fear of anything. He was only happy when he was doing things that he think that maybe killed his life doing it. Like the paragliding. I mean, his feet were so broken in so many parts. I don't know how the guy can still walk. But he was a lovely guy. He was just, I remember the first time we gave him a chance, or Ken gave him a chance to drive for Tirreli. It was at Clermont-Ferrand. It was a difficult place to get in, and he got in late. We were about to go, and he got late, so he got his first bollocking from Ken. but he was just such a fearless guy. He just, mind you, when you think about him, most of the drivers, Josef, that was another one that he couldn't, it was just never have experienced what it is to be afraid of, have fear of something. Depailler was a very quiet guy, I think. It didn't mix as much with the guys of his times, like Lafitte or Jarier. They were all people that were more loud Frenchmen. But Patrick was quieter and as I said, fearless guy. He was good. He was quick. And it was nice and easy to work with him. I can't remember much more.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so we move on to McLaren. We had quite a few questions from readers come in about your time at McLaren. So we start with Giovanni, who asked, how was it to work with Niki Lauda during 1984 when he won his third title? Did you already know him from previous years?
You know, out of all of the drivers that have been involved, with just about all of them have a very good relationship. But with Niki, he was a very enigmatic kind of personality. It was more difficult to get close to him. All of his closest friends, they were all Austrians, and he used to come often with his own friends at the circuit. And yes, it was not easy to get close to him. Having said that, on my retiring party at Indianapolis, he was the first to arrive, you know. And he said, oh, Nicky, great to see you. The first said, yes, I come because I don't believe you're going to retire. I just want to make sure you have here. And it was brilliant. And then when he finished his career, he wrote this book, From Hell and Back. And it's one of the best reading racing books that I have read. And I was so sorry that having read that, and then when I saw Nicky and I said, I wish I would have, I couldn't read the book before because you haven't written it before you were with us, because I would understand a lot more how you tick, and maybe I would have been closer relation, friendship than I ever did with him. Yes, it's it was I wouldn't say difficult. It was, he had a very difficult time with McLaren because Prost was so much quicker than him, and he really tried hard, but he realized that. So he tried to always beat Prost outside the car. In the car, he knew he could never beat him. And I always felt that that particular year, because of the way the championship counted, he won 5 races and Alain won 7. I think Alain should have been the champion, and but how it happened. And if Alain would have finished 2nd in Monaco, the full race, and he would have had 6 points, he would have been the champion. So anyway, it's hard, but and that last race was incredible. I think Alain was 1st or 2nd, and Nicky was 11. I think, if I don't remember, unless I'm very much mistaken, he was really...
He was about 11th, yeah.
Yes, and he only needed to be 2nd or to win the championship. You know? So Alain needed to be 1st, and Alain was 1st. And then towards the end, you know, cars were falling apart, and he was making room and getting better and quicker and whatever. And then he got up to 3rd. And then, was it De Angelis or Mansell in front? And I can't remember which of the two. Anyway, he broke his car, and then he looked at the 2nd, and no, couldn't believe it, no way. Who was that? Then next I tried to see who was the car that stopped there, and he said, oh, I couldn't see it before, and I couldn't believe I'm a 2nd. I'm saying, I'm world champion. He said, oh, the car is starting to make noise. The brake pedal, it was very long. It's all rubbish, you know. He was just so hesitant to be champion. He couldn't believe. He said, no, something's going to happen. Then, no, of course, nothing happened. It was all his imagination. He won the race, and... it was world champion. Yes, an amazing. We didn't have it was in Portugal, so it was the last race of the year. And I remember I booked everybody to get back to England on the Tuesday, because I knew on the Monday we were not in any condition. And the party finished at 9 o'clock in the morning. It was unbelievable. Yes, good memories. I mean, we had to do a good party. I thought I could live 100 years. No one would make, again, 12 wins out of 15 races or out of 16 races. And 4 years later, yes, we had 15 out of 16. Incredible.
What were the circumstances that led you to McLaren? I mean, how did your job with McLaren come about? Did Ron contact you? Did you contact Ron?
We were friends. Ron and I, in my book, I said that for the first 10 years we were friends, and the other 20 years he was my boss. But yeah, we used to, because he was working at Cooper's, and I don't remember where I was working at the time, and then we used to, in racing, even if you were in different teams, they were much, much closer, the camaraderie between them, because all the teams, there were 10 people, so everybody know each other. I used to play squash with Ron every weekend. We were not racing or something. We had played once in Maidenhead, and then he came, while he was living in Maidenhead, and then he came home for the lunch. Or we play in walking, and I used to come home with lunch with him, with his original girlfriend, not with Lisa. So we were good friends, and then he's starting to get very successful. I always knew that he was going to be, get places. He was so, first of all, he had this ability to see how the future was coming. He had it on his mind, and he was very good in every respect. And anyway, he was successful with his Formula 2 team, and he, one year he got a lot of sponsorship. And he said, "Ron, why don't we, Joe? Why don't you make another team? And I put some of your sponsors to you to start with." And then by then I was with working with Shadow, with Elio De Angelis and Jan Lammers, I think. And we were not winning any races, but we had so much fun. And I was really enjoyed. But I was my boss, you know. I used to. I didn't have anybody. Well, Don Nichols, but he come only once a year or whatever, and I would really enjoy it. And I said, "No, where do I want to do a Formula 2 team? I'm enjoying being in Formula 1." And anyway, time went by, and then I was in the Theodoro, and he by then he'd already took over McLaren in 1981, and he called. He offered me a job then, but. McLaren, you have John Barnard, Taro Alexander. It was so many top people up there. And I said, what am I going to do? I'd rather be a big fish in a small pond than the other way around. And I didn't accept it. And then the next year came the turbo era. We had not a turbo era engine, and we wouldn't have chance of getting a turbo engine. I was thinking to go into the States where I had some offers. And then fortunately for me, Ron called again, you know, and said, what about this year? Are you going to come to, look, we have the Porsche engines and we have a good, you know. So I went and have an interview with him and John Barnard, and I was playing hard to get, but inside me I said, yes, I want this job. and I got it. This is how it started.
I had a question actually about Ron from Anthony Jenkins. McLaren right now, he says, are a shambles. Would this have happened under Ron Dennis?
No. Mind you, Ron was there at the beginning of the
decline.
The decline. So it's difficult to say. No, it wouldn't get to this point. Certainly not. But so good Ron was at... yes, he himself made mistakes, and it's for sure he wouldn't. This was not the way he wanted to end up the emporium that he built up. But he would only know exactly why. For anybody else that was in Ron era, see what's happened to McLaren now. I tell you, I cry, and the races is horrible. It's
one. Other quick question about Ron from Girardo. It wants to take you back to Indy 2001, Mika Häkkinen's final win. He said, in your book, the bit where you explain how Ron made you think you were going up to the podium made him feel sick for the sheer lack of respect. With the benefit of hindsight, how do you rate Ron now? Are you friends? Have you mended the bridges of...
It's funny, you know, like I said at the beginning, that he was my friend for 10 years, and then my boss for the last 20. I was very surprised at what happened in Watkins Glen then. But that's wrong, you know. He's always wanted, and Watkins Glen, no,
Indianapolis,
yeah. Was a very special, I was retiring. All of the sponsors got together and Ron to make a superb party about me. So I was like, you know, the cat whistles at the time. Everybody wanted a piece of me, everybody. And Ron hated it. Ron hated it that I was taking the light lime out of the weekend. And I think that's why he said, no, you should not go in the podium. But anyway, it was good to finish my racing life with the first and third, with Michael Schumacher in the middle.
Yep.
Yeah, it was a great weekend. But yes, Ron is Ron. He's like that. I mean, it's just like he knew my wife, he knew my daughter so well. he used to love my daughter. I was always making jokes with when I took her to the races. But that weekend, he kind of ignored them, like if they were not there. You know, it was so. I still cannot understand it, but that was wrong.
Yeah. I think it was at Silverstone in 2001 when Mika Häkkinen and David Coulthard presented you with a Harley Davidson, didn't they, as a forthcoming retirement gift?
Yes.
I think a gesture like that from two races. I mean, I don't imagine it does. Well, that kind of thing doesn't happen very often, does it? Certainly not in the. I still call that the modern era. I mean, that was a. I mean, how did you have any clue that was happening?
Not at all.
I remember standing at the photo shoot and you looked very surprised.
Not at all. That was in Hungary. That was my birthday. That was my 60.
I was in Hungary. Yeah, okay. So
my 60-year birthday, and that was the year that I was retiring. Mm. So they decide to between David and Mika to give me the bike, and I just wow, you know. I now just remember it because I couldn't believe it, you know. And I remember that I was working in the transporter, and the girls came, so they need you in the motorhome. So I went to the motorhome, it was empty. What did they need me here for? And so I went back to her, and then he came back again. No, they need me. Yeah, I've been there, but nobody. Yeah, we stayed there a little bit. So I went back there, and then I was there. And from one door, David Coulthard come, and Mika Häkkinen on the other side with a leather jacket, you know. And you like leather jacket? Yeah, it's great. So I put it there, and as I put it on, I see Harley Davidson, and say, "Oh, great! All I need is
a bike.
It's a bike." Huh? And then I hear ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, the Harley Davidson, black shiny Harley coming in, and you like it? Poof, I love it. It's yours. Wow! Even now, I
have you still got it?
Yeah. Oh, we use it a lot. Not so much lately, and now I have other classic cars and other things to do, and Ursula don't like it so much now. we went to Portugal a couple of times, we went to Morocco, we all of Andalusia. Yeah, we really have a good use of it, but now, you know, getting old, you got a problem. We had a couple of little not accidents, incidents, but you have an accident at our age and, you know, it's very difficult to recover. Like it happened to Dan Gurney. He had an accident on his alligator and that was the beginning of his downfall.
Did you ride the bike back from Hungary or did they put it in the truck for you?
No, they put it in the truck. Yes.
Now, we are running out of time, so we really need to touch on Senna and Prost because we've had, I think, lots of questions about, unsurprisingly, about that time. So we've had some questions from S404 and 1500 quid about Senna and Prost and the engines being given to Prost, because I think I read somewhere that Senna was a Honda driver with McLaren chassis and Prost was a McLaren driver with Honda engines. Was there any truth in that?
No. It's true that Ayrton was a Honda driver with a McLaren chassis, and that Prost the contrary, but there was not true whatsoever about the engines. The engines were always the same. In fact, it was at some stage, he was the number one mechanic on each car that picked up the engines were there and he picked up one. So there was absolutely the same engines all the time. It's just that was one of the things. Prost never could use the power band of the engine, the way that Ayrton used to use it. It was superb. Ayrton always kept the engine, always kept the revs up. And Alain tried to do it in a corner, and he said, "It's no way, I can't do it." So he said, "You know, those 8 meters in front that he takes, he deserves it because I tried, I can't do it." But he's very good at keeping the rev up. And that was the only, that was a big difference between the two of them in a lap in qualifying. This is why Ayrton was such unbelievable. How could anybody be a second quicker than Prost in a circuit that like Monaco and Spa, where a line always kind of made the difference between the other drivers? And yeah, it was amazing. Having said that, the main difference between them is that if you give a line a car that is a 100% of his liking, he was unbeatable. But how often you get a car that is 100% to your like? Very seldom. While Ayrton could improvise and change his driving to suit the car and then manage to get quicker. Alain was always a better driver to set up the car. Ayrton tried so many things in practice to get the car going, and in the end he said, no, we'll forget it, just put it same as Alain. And he knew if the car is same as Alain, he can beat it. But it was great to be. I mean, I put that in my book, which I loved it. It was the French Grand Prix. On those days, if you were quick in practice, you get four sets of qualified. So he got four sets of qualified for the qualified 1 hour qualified we had, and there was no limiting in laps. You can use it whatever, do whatever you like, and. Alain went up, set up the pole position, the preliminary pole position or whatever you call it, and he get off the car. And he said, what are you doing? You're crazy. We still have another three sets of tires. Oh, forget it. If he can do a lap quicker than this, he deserved the pole. He quick puts his T-shirt and jeans, and he went in the pit lane watching the race. Ah, the more watching the practice, the more Ayrton see him, the faster he tried to go and the slower he got. And then we get to Portugal, where in Portugal Ayrton had a good car, and he did the same to Alain. So this is the sort of thing, games that we have between them that we, as a team, loved it so much because they don't know whether if they, for sure they knew how much between them they push McLaren to the front. It was amazing. It was brilliant.
Bill in Sydney asked, when did Prost get his first clear idea of just how fast Senna was? Do you think there was one moment where he thought?
Yes. It was in Belgium, qualified in Belgium. Ayrton used to get in such a trance when he qualified that he went inside the transport to change his clothes. But before he changed his clothes, he used to sit there and just puts his head down like that, and we just left him because we knew he was just kind of going back to normal after the qualifying, because he did it's something I'd never seen on any other sportsman to try so hard to something that he really wanted. Anyway, and we were at the end, the other end of the transport with Alain, and I was looking at the times, and Alain was looking, but where in the world he's taking that much time, I can't believe it, of all places in here. And I can see Ayrton can hear what we were talking, but and Alain was this way, so he couldn't see Ayrton. And then Alain said, I just don't understand where he takes all that time. He must be effing quick. And then I look at Ayrton turned around to me and he closed an eye. I think that was the moment that for Ayrton, finally, you know, when he got to McLaren, Alain was number one. So he just wanted to beat Alain. He didn't care about Mansell, Rosberg, anybody, just Alain. And beating them for a second at Belgium, he then decided, this is it. I am now no more. And in the same thing was when Prost said, yes, he is very, very quick.
Anthony Jenkins actually asks if you think Alain Prost is one of the greatest ever.
I think Alain, because the way sometimes, I don't understand, he doesn't figure as much as high up as he should. And to me, for sure, he's, I'll be biased because I worked with him for so long, but without a doubt, it's a guy that was totally incapable of making mistakes, and not because he was slow, you know. But yes, I think the history don't treat him as he deserved, but he's certainly one of the very top, you can, 10 drivers. I probably put it even top of the top six drivers.
Do you think part of that is a consequence of Prost's driving style? Because he was very, very fast, but he was also very efficient, and he didn't look, whereas Senna, the sparks coming off the car, he's over curbs, he's sideways, he's fighting the wheel. He had a much more aggressive driving style. Do you think that people don't appreciate just how good Alain was because he did it with such economy of style?
I think you can possibly put the nail on the head because, yes, I think that you're very right. He didn't look. I mean, at the end of the race, you take the gearbox apart and the gears of Alain could do another race. Yeah. The brakes of Alain could do. I mean, the difference, not so much with Ayrton, but say, like, when we have Keke Rosberg,
yes,
the difference. Keke Rosberg could not finish a race because he just finished the brakes, and Alain could have done two races with the same brakes. It's amazing. It's so smooth. It's what makes Alain so good. And yes, it was of course the difference for the public. They see it, you know, the other guy is better, but maybe because he's driving it sideways, he's losing time and it's not appreciated. But we used to tell him, when you do a quick one, let us know because we're going to miss
you
it.
You can't tell.
Yeah, we can't tell, really. You know? And he was a guy like, it's amazing qualifiers. If Piquet or Rosberg, they go in a lap time, I know, 29.5, he get back in the car and he did 29.4. And I said, bloody hell, how could you do that? I don't know. He could never didn't have the answers, but it's true. He just, enough, you know. Like Fangio always used to say, the secret of winning races is to win in at the slowest possible speed. For sure, you got to conserve everything else. And Alain was a specialist.
One last question on Prost and Senna. This comes from Glenn Alcock. He says, you managed to stay neutral in the Senna and Prost battles. How difficult was that? And how did you manage to keep Senna's trust?
For me, it was easy. My job was to make working with the drivers and the mechanics and the engineers and... I wasn't there at the time they were signing the contracts. I didn't never spoke about money with them, and so it was easy for me to be a friend of two of them. And when the things got a bit sticky, I used to think of something funny that stopped them thinking of that. Just tried to change the conversation completely and go in another way. And yeah, it seems to work because. Both of them, I believe they did trust me, and it was, as I said before, not easy. You really have to think about it. How are you going to get into? It was not easy, but it was a super stage of my life. I mean, I remember when they. When Prost went to Ferrari, and I said to Ayrton, I said, look, you're going to see each other often in the podium, so you may as well finish your, you know, shake hands and be, you with that effing frog? No way. But I keep working at it, and in the last race, they actually got together, and it was something missing because on the last, the last race of Alain was in Adelaide, but in Japan they were going to exchange helmets. For some reason I don't remember now, it didn't happen, and it was sad. But I was so happy that in Adelaide they get together and they embrace each other and so on. I mean, they were so good. And they would have so much respect one another that I'm sure if it didn't happen what it happened in Imola, they would become friends for sure. But there you are.
And then after Senna Prost came Senna Schumacher. And Entropy, a commenter on the website, has asked what your take on that rivalry was. Was it because Senna felt disrespected by Schumacher, or seeing a young upcoming driver as a threat, you think?
Oh, yes, for sure. Ayrton knew he was going to be his next stronger rival. And I remember at Magny-Cours, I can't remember which year, but when Schumacher started to go in, they had a crash. What, I don't remember the reason, but obviously it was between them, and Ayrton believed it was Michael's fault. So then the race was stopped, the rain or something happened, the race was stopped, and it was a restart. At the restart, Ayrton said to me, "You watch Michael." So and he went out to talk to Michael before the restart. And you could see him. I don't know what they were talking, but you could see he was pointing out and putting the finger at. And Michael was very serious. Listen, he didn't say anything. Listen. And then he came back, said, "Good, it's now a little bit destabilized for the race, I think." And in fact, something happened, and he went off soon after the start. So yes, he knew that he was... I've always, and I said to Michael that I was very appreciate that when he broke one of the records of maybe the number of races. Yes, when he surpassed the number of race wins of Ayrton. And Michael said, "No, this is not a record for nothing. To me, I don't, why, it's nothing. You know, everybody knows if Ayrton was alive, he would have won a lot of the races that I have won now. So I wouldn't have, this doesn't mean anything for me." I think that was good of him to say that. But yes, it is very true that for us, the fans in general, we lost a great battles that we would have with Michael and Ayrton.
I think I read somewhere that Martin Brundle said Senna was more obsessed with Schumacher, and Schumacher didn't really consider the relationship a rivalry. Maybe. Do you agree with that? There was more Senna pushing the rivalry more than Schumacher.
Yes. Yes, it's true to say, because you know he was established and Michael was on the ladder. Yes.
And then just to finish up, we have three hopefully quick fire questions. Simon, you can answer some of these as well. So Matt has asked, over one lap, Häkkinen or Senna, who would you choose?
Over one lap?
One lap.
Oh, Senna, yes. No,
we don't. Okay, yeah. Close, but...
Yeah, it was good. I mean, when Mika was our test driver, and he was just couldn't wait when he was going to drive, and eventually we got rid of Michael Andretti, and he got to Portugal, his first race, and of course he wanted so much to get to drive, and it got Senna with his trousers down, for sure. He just didn't expect it. And I remember after in the debriefing, after you couldn't take the smile out of Mika, you know. And Senna, he was so mad. What the F you smiling for, you know? What have you done, you know? And tomorrow you won't last me a lap. You know, he was, and the next day, it after the start, he passed him on the grass, and he just really made a point, like, you know, you're nobody. He used to love that, to put his other driver down so much. Like, I remember testing in Hungary, Jonathan Palmer was the test driver, and then... Ayrton came to drive the next day, and when he came to the circuit, we would still have half an hour, and said, "Would you like to drive the car now? So maybe you need to change the gear ratios or something, so we don't lose time tomorrow." "Yeah, sure, I do a lap." So he did a lap, and he was 1.5 seconds quicker than Jonathan had done. Just one lap in 2 days. So Jonathan said, "Well, I guess if you don't need me tomorrow, I could get a flight tonight back to London." Yes, it always, for him, I mean, the competition was, Senna was always being qualified, practice or tested Senna. So the competition was after Senna, and that's how he kind of, he'd love to do that, yeah.
Bill in Sydney has another question. If you were running a four-car team with Prost, Senna, Lauda and Stewart in their prime, what order would they finish and why?
Prost,
Senna, Lauda and Stewart.
presumably all the cars finished. Yeah, I think Ayrton would have won. Prost, Stewart, and Lauda, I think.
Any reason? Or?
I guess probably, no reason. To me, there was, if I have to cross the first five ever of history, I would say it was Fangio. He was good, and he was in, I respect so much the way he did his life and his wins and so on. Clark, because I just missed a little bit. No, I got some of Clark's, but I would have liked to be a little bit early too. He was unbelievable. And then we have Senna, Prost, and Stewart. And I'm so glad that I worked with the three of those five.
Simon, your top four in that order?
From the race?
From the race.
I think I'd probably go Senna first, dead heat for second between Prost and Stewart, and Lauda fourth. Yeah.
Okay. And then one final thing before we finish. Have you been impressed by Sergio Perez since he joined Force India? That's a question from Dan. Have you been impressed by Sergio Perez?
Now, yes.
He joined Force India?
Yes, I think he's very good. I mean, he start, unfortunately, he got in too young and he did big mistakes, and his relation with McLaren was no good when they got out of McLaren. I didn't think he was going to get a drive, because then, okay, the car wasn't good at that time, but it's still McLaren was McLaren. So you have you drive for a top team like McLaren and they let you go, then the other top teams, well, why? Like, you know, it's a bad thing on your curriculum. He may wouldn't even have another opportunity. Having said that, because of the lack of drivers, whatever, he got another opportunity with Force India. Martin Whitmarsh was very good helping him to do that. And it was good for him that the car was good and he was able to do some good racing. And since then, he's get better and better, not only as a driver, but as a person. I think he got in the sport too soon, too young. He made big mistakes of being young, and he's regrettable now, but he still was able to rebuild, reinvented himself and carry on with his career. And I think, unfortunately, there are no top drives anymore. Very difficult to get a drive on the top team, but what he's got is good. Made no mistakes. He's good with the tires. He's good with the car. Gets the car to the end, and he's been in the points very regularly. So it's good, and I hope he continue, because if we don't have a Mexican driver, we probably won't have a Mexican Grand Prix, and you know, it's very important for a country to be involved.
Sure. I think we've just about covered everything in the time. So thank you so much for joining us, Joe.
A pleasure.
I'm sure there's more nice we can
do. I think we should get you back for chapter two. I've got more questions, but for another time.
But before we go, I have been asked to point out that we have our first ever track day come up on October the 5th at Thruxton. And if you want to know more about that, just go to our website, which is motorsportmagazine.com. So if you want to get on track at Thruxton, some of us will be there knocking around. So I hope to see you then. Joe, thanks again. And we'll be back soon. Thanks, Simon. with our next guest. Thanks a lot.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.